anything that I was doing here with the Case for Christ stuff that we've been going through. And so he offered to do his own thing, and I said that it was perfectly fine. We are going to be moving on. So one of the things that we have done so far with this study is look at the eyewitness evidence. You know, the Gospels are either written by eyewitnesses or people who were closely associated with eyewitnesses. And what that should do for us, the practical takeaway that we can take away, I guess, with that is that if somebody wants to talk to us about, you know, can we trust the Gospels? You know, I'm not really sure if the Bible is God's Word, or if they just tell you flat out, I don't believe the Bible is God's Word. You can talk to them about, you know, some of the historical environment from which the Gospels came. And you can actually have a meaningful dialogue with them and say, well, you know, we've got these different things that we look at, and you know, the Gospels do kind of meet these to different degrees. And so it's, they really do come to us as historical documents that it's appropriate, it's okay to ask historical questions about. So that's the whole thing that we wanted to go through, you know, and show you. And that's what Lee Strobel was trying to do here in his first chapter in The Case for Christ when he interviewed Dr. Craig Blomberg. The next chapter is about the documentary evidence, and we're talking about the text of the Gospels themselves. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the actual, you know, documents that were written and copied and read in churches and copied and lost and, you know, later found thousands of years later in trash heaps in Egypt. That happens. We'll get to some of that later. You know, that's the kind of thing that we are going to be talking about today. And this is, to me, I find a lot of this stuff really fascinating because as much as we hold up the Bible in high regard, and we should, there's a lot that I didn't know about it when I was a young Christian. I didn't know how we got it. I didn't know how it came down to us. I just kind of thought that once Matthew wrote his gospel, every Christian would have known, oh, well, this is scripture on par with Deuteronomy, or on par with the rest of the Old Testament, and so that they just kept passing it down. I didn't know that there were other things going on. So, anyway, what I want to first mention is these books by a certain gentleman who is a professor at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His name is Bart Ehrman. Listen to this title. It's really frustrating. Misquoting Jesus, the story behind who changed the Bible and why. So that's Bart Ehrman. Doesn't sound like he's a big fan of the Bible, does he? Here's another good one. Lost Christianities, the Battles for Scripture and the Faiths We Never Knew, by Bart Ehrman. So, Bart Ehrman, what's that, Mary? Yeah, well, if you read this, he claims to be able to tell you who did it. So here's the thing about a gentleman like Bart Ehrman, and I'm going to focus on some things that he says in this book, just as by way of introduction. You can find these books at really any bookstore. So if you happen to find yourself in a bookstore, you know, I do occasionally enjoy just perusing the shelves, seeing what's out there. You can find the stuff in the Bible and religion section. And I remember distinctly as a kid in youth group, looking through, you know, bookshelves. My mom was a librarian. I had no choice but to be constantly surrounded by books. So, I mean, that just, yeah, that's how it was. And she's run the church library at their church, you know, ever since I have been alive. So, anyway, I had no choice but to just be interested and surrounded by books all the time. So when I was, you know, with mom and she would be, you know, at the bookstore or something like that, I would find myself in one of two areas, the Bible and religion section or the history section. you know, U.S. military history I found interesting, you know, world history, stuff like that. So I would see things like this, and immediately I would get nervous and think, uh-oh, what do you mean? What do you mean, who changed the Bible? What do you mean, misquoting Jesus? And I would see that, and I would be nervous, and I wouldn't want to dig into it because I didn't think that I knew answers. I didn't think that I knew the answers to that. I was young in my faith. I was a teenager, immature and stupid in a lot of ways, but just young in my faith. And so I was nervous. It's like, I'll set that aside for right now. And then I would go find, you know, another author I would know, somebody like C.S. Lewis or somebody like that. It wasn't until I started going through my Bible classes at Harding, and especially when I started learning Greek and taking classes to show us how we got our Greek New Testament. It wasn't until I started going this kind of stuff that I began to feel like I could answer some of the issues that Bart Ehrman raises. Now, here's the thing. Bart Ehrman's not dumb. It'd be easy just to dismiss him and say, oh, well, he's stupid. He didn't know what he's talking about. And just dismiss him and, you know, he's a crazy person. He's a professor at a major university and is a big name in biblical studies. Garrett and I are constantly running into arguments that he makes because this is the kind of stuff that we have to deal with at school. And so it's one thing to say, well, I don't like what he's saying, but it's another thing to actually have to deal with that because he isn't dumb. He's actually pretty smart. But that doesn't mean that he can't be wrong on some things. So here's something that I wanted to read a quote from Bart Ehrman. This is in his introduction. Bart Ehrman, he started out as a very faithful and dedicated Christian in his early life. And the more he recognized that maybe some things weren't exactly how he always thought they were, he really started to question his faith. And it's so funny, anytime anybody tries to do what Garrett and I do, which is, you know, go and, you know, get a doctorate in the Bible or something like that, I mean, people do honestly come up to us and say, you know, they ask us, are you losing your faith? Because that happens to a lot of people, unfortunately. Unfortunately. Garrett, have you had somebody basically ask you, are you still teaching truth because of your studies? Maybe we should have talked about this earlier. But you know that there are some people who don't really think that there is much merit to what we're doing. Yeah. So anyway, this is a quote from Bart Ehrman. He's talking about when folks like Matthew, Mark, and Luke first wrote their first copy of their Gospels. Bart Ehrman says, we don't have any of the originals, and that's true. We don't have the actual copy that Paul held in his hand when he wrote this to the Corinthians or whatever. He says, not only do we not have the originals, we don't have the first copies of the originals. We don't even have the copies of the originals or copies of the copies of the originals. What we have are copies made later, much later. In most instances, they are copies made centuries later. And he put centuries in italics, so you would really get that it's been a long time. And these copies all differ from one another in many thousands of places. As we will see later in this book, I'm talking about this one, these copies differ from one another in so many places that we don't even know how many differences there are. Possibly it's easiest to put it in comparative terms. There are more differences among our manuscripts, so handwritten copies of the New Testament. There are more differences among our manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. Sounds pretty bleak, doesn't it? Bart Ehrman paints a scary picture. What if he's right? What if there are differences among each of our handwritten copies of the Bible? What does that mean for us as Christians? Well, the fact of the matter is, he is right to some degree. There are differences in all of our different copies. There are differences in our copies. And that's something that Christians have always known about until the invention of the printing press, when it was easier to make sure that there were no differences. The second interview in the Lee Strobel's book is with a gentleman who deals with those differences, a guy named Bruce Metzger. He's a professor of New Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary, very sharp guy. He was a prolific author on New Testament, Greek. So Joe asked me, we're not going to have to read all these, are you? These are just some of the ones that I grabbed from my own bookshelf of things written by Bruce Metzger. Manuscripts of the Greek Bible. I think this is a good guy to interview. Here's another one. The Early Versions of the New Testament. So talking about Latin, Coptic, other translations of the New Testament. Here's one. This is the Greek New Testament. No, he didn't write that. He's not that old. But he is on the editorial board for the group that helped put this together. Something that almost every New Testament student has. And here is another book written by Bruce Metzger, The Text of the New Testament, where he talks about some of these differences and things like that. Bruce Metzger, this guy knows what he's talking about. And he also firmly believed in Jesus Christ as Lord. So, he was also on the editorial board of the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible. So, this guy knows what he's talking about. He knows tons of old languages and things like that. He passed away in 2007. And so, there is unfortunately not a lot of great video about him and things that he has to say. So, I want to introduce you first to some key terms and definitions, and then I will introduce you to another guy. Now, I've mentioned this just a minute ago. We're going to watch a video here, not from Bruce Metzger, but from another gentleman who I think very highly of. And Garrett and I have actually got to meet this guy. But he's going to use some terms that you just kind of need to know what they are. So, a manuscript is like a handwritten copy of something. And so what they would do is, because they didn't have the printing press until it was invented in the 1400s, and so they had to handwrite everything. All of our copies of the Bible, everything, anything, had to be handwritten. And what they would originally write on was stuff called papyrus. It's a plant that grew around the Nile River, and you would take its long stalks, cut it, you would basically shave it, lay it out flat, let it dry. Its natural juices acted kind of like a glue. And when it dried, it was usable enough to become paper, to become some kind of paper. And so papyrus is, if you have a papyrus manuscript, that means you've got a handwritten document on this leaf paper, basically. Papyri is just the plural, so you have one papyrus, multiple papyri. And this is a funny word, papyrology. Say that five times fast. Papyrology is just the study of these kinds of manuscripts. Now you think, well, that sounds super boring. Actually, no, because based on things like handwriting and what kind of currency they refer to in that document, you can date these manuscripts. Pretty neat. Pretty neat. And because they're so delicate and so fragile, you don't want to like cut a piece off to use for carbon dating, because you have to destroy something like that in order to do that. So they have other ways to date these things. Another thing you need to know about is the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. I'll point us to a website later on in class, but this is a fascinating thing that this group goes around and they photograph all these old manuscripts that are just in these random libraries in places like Greece and Italy and all this stuff, and they put them online. And you can see these wonderful, beautiful old manuscripts of the Bible. It's amazing. And then textual criticism. If you have your Bibles, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13 for me, please. I want to give just a brief example of what's going on here. Just a brief example of what textual criticism is. Now, it doesn't mean you're criticizing the text like you're saying it's wrong. It means you're trying to determine what was the original thing that was written. Chris, what are you reading back there? King James? Okay, thank you, sir. Chris, read for us 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 3. So charity, just another word for love in Shakespearean times, which is when the King James was put together. So he says, and if I hand over my body that I may what?
Be burned.
Be burned. Okay. Garrett, you have the ESV, correct?
Yep.
Will you read for us? 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 3. ESV?
Yeah.
It does. Okay. All right. So it seems like that Paul is talking about being burned here in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 3. Does anybody have an NIV around? Wesley? Jamie? Chesley? Wesley is a friend of Garrett's and mine from school. You can meet him later, not to put him on the spot. Jamie, you said you've got NIV? Will you read for us, please, 1 Corinthians 13, verse 3? That's NIV? What is going on here? Okay. I'm going to read for us the New Revised Standard Version. You see all of these say burned, right? If I give away all of my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Now, what's the difference there? Why? What has happened? All of these respected translations say burned, but another respected translation says boast. What's the deal? Well, that's something that textual criticism, it's our last term here, talks about. It asks the question, what's up with these differences? Where do they come from? And what can we learn about them? So I want to introduce you to Daniel Wallace, Dr. Daniel Wallace. He's a professor of New Testament at Dallas Theological Seminary. He is a prolific author on Greek and textual criticism. Here are some things that I have from Daniel Wallace. Greek grammar beyond the basics. If you are looking for something that will put you fast asleep, this is it. Here is another good one. The Reliability of the New Testament. Bart Ehrman and Daniel Wallace in Dialogue. Okay, so I think you know which side Daniel Wallace is on. And here is another one, Revisiting the Corruption of the New Testament. And he doesn't think that it was actually corrupted, just spoiler alert. Manuscript, Patristic, and Apocryphal Evidence. Daniel B. Wallace, editor. And those are just a couple of things that I had from Daniel Wallace. He is also the director for the Center of the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. And if you want to write down this website, I encourage you to go check it out. It's the website I was telling you about earlier, CSNTM.org. If you want to write that down, CSNTM.org. If you don't have anything to write with, you can ask me about that later. I want us to watch a video of Daniel Wallace. It's about 15 minutes long. I know that's a little bit longer than what we normally do for videos, but it makes up for the last couple weeks where I couldn't find any good videos of Craig Blomberg that I wanted to show you. Daniel Wallace talks about the different manuscripts we have, how old they are, you know, what kinds of things that we can learn from this sort of stuff. I promise it will be worth it. So here's Daniel Wallace.
When we come to the text of the New Testament and try and determine what the autographs are actually about, one of the great problems we have is the amount of material that we have to look at. Now, I'm going to compare this material to what other ancient Greco-Roman literature looks like in terms of their material remains of these various authors. And that's why I've entitled this lesson, An Embarrassment of Riches. So if we take, for example, three Roman historians from the first century approximately AD, on whom we're basing most of our understanding of what ancient Rome was like, we've got Livy, Suetonius, and Tacitus. Now, Livy, we are waiting 300 years before we see any copies of his writings, and we don't see the full array of what he wrote about Roman history. Most of it's simply lost forever without any knowledge of where it went to. We have a grand total of about 30 copies of Livy in existence today that we can examine to try to see what he had to say. Another ancient Roman historian was known as Tacitus, and we are waiting for 800 years before we see any copies of Tacitus's works, and the grand total that we have are three copies of Tacitus, and yet he's one of the great Roman historians to give us the information we need on the history of Rome in and around the first century AD, as well as before that time. A third author, Suetonius, we have quite a bit of material from Suetonius. We have over 200 manuscripts from Suetonius. But again, like Tacitus, we are waiting 800 years before we get any copies of his writings. Now, if we were to compare this to the New Testament documents, you would see that we have an embarrassment of riches. And it truly is an embarrassment for New Testament scholars, which creates kind of an existential crisis of how do we approach this material? What can we safely disregard, at least to some extent, as we examine the more important materials? Here's the data. We have, for our New Testament manuscripts, at the present time, close to 5,800 copies of these manuscripts in Greek alone. Now, if you were to wipe out all of the Greek manuscripts, this is what the text of the New Testament was originally written in, Greek. If you were to wipe out all of those, we could still reproduce the text of the New Testament many, many times over from the witnesses that we have in Latin, which were as early as the second century. And the Latin text, we have over 10,000 copies of Latin manuscripts of the New Testament in existence today. We can reproduce the text in Latin and Coptic. Coptic is an ancient Egyptian language. It's essentially Egyptian hieroglyphics that are put into Greek letters. And the Coptic text starts as early as the 3rd century. We have hundreds of Coptic manuscripts today. In fact, we have probably at least 1,500 Coptic manuscripts, if not quite a few more, that have not yet been cataloged. All around the world, there's many, many Coptic New Testament manuscripts that are simply not yet cataloged and therefore not known to New Testament scholars. Besides Coptic, we also have Syriac, another very, very important ancient copy of the New Testament, and we have hundreds of copies of Syriac. Then the New Testament was translated into many other languages. It was translated into Georgian, into Gothic, into Arabic. It was translated into Old Church Slavonic, into Anglo-Saxon and Armenian. We have so many copies of the New Testament in all these versions that there are surely between 15,000 and 20,000 copies of the New Testament, not in Greek, written on handwritten manuscripts. So it's an embarrassment of riches. Then you add to that the over 5,000 copies of the New Testament in Greek, and we've got over 20,000 copies, well over 20,000 copies most likely, of the New Testament in various languages before the time of the printing press. Now I should mention something that is true both for the New Testament and for these other ancient authors, and that is this. A copy of one of these ancient documents does not mean that it's a complete copy. We have our earliest manuscripts for the New Testament, as well as the earliest manuscripts for Livy and for Suetonius and Tacitus, are going to be those that are fragmentary texts. The earlier you go, the less likely it is that you're going to have a complete copy. In fact, the oldest complete New Testament manuscript that we have in existence, which happens to be in Greek, and it happens to be an exceedingly important manuscript, is Codex Sinaiticus, which is housed now at the British Library in London. It's written in about the middle of the 4th century, somewhere around AD 350, give or take 25 years, and it's a complete New Testament. That's our oldest complete New Testament. However, we also have a number of manuscripts that, although fragmentary, have quite a bit of text up to that point. Now, I've mentioned the number of copies we have for the New Testament, and that gives us an embarrassment of riches. But I haven't talked to you about the dates. As you recall, with Livy, Suetonius, and Tacitus, we're dealing with the earliest manuscripts coming 300 years, and those are only of Livy. And then Suetonius and Tacitus were waiting 800 years before we get copies. These are fairly representative for ancient Greco-Roman authors. The best among them is going to be Homer, and of course Homer has an 800 year head start over first century authors, so he's got quite a few more copies than these other authors do, but not more copies than in the New Testament. Homer is in a league by itself, but I'll just summarize this and say that we have approximately 1,000% as many copies of the New Testament in its various languages as we do copies of Homer. It's a remarkable difference, and he is in second place in terms of literary remains among all Greco-Roman literature. Huge disparity. Now, in terms of the date of these New Testament manuscripts, the earliest come from the second century, from within 100 years of the completion of the New Testament. Scholars have pointed to a fragment of John's Gospel known as P52, or papyrus number 52, that is housed at Manchester University in the John Rylands Library today. Manchester University in central England had a scholar who was wrestling with the data in the library back in 1934, and he was a bona fide papyrologist. His name was Colin H. Roberts. He found this fragment in the John Rylands Library, and he said, "This looks like it's from the New Testament." I mean, he was a papyrologist, so he's dealing with other kinds of texts, and looking for a New Testament manuscript among the papyri is like looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. About 0.1% of all published papyri are actually New Testament manuscripts, so it's pretty hard to find them. But he discovered this quite by accident and said, "I think this is from the New Testament." Sure enough, it was. On one side of this papyrus leaf was John chapter 18, verses 31 through 33, and on the other side was John 18, verses 37 and 38. And so a year later, Roberts published this papyrus, P52. It got published in 1935, but he had circulated photographs of it to the three leading papyrologists of Europe at the time, and each one independently wrote back to him and said, "We believe that this manuscript should be dated no later than AD 150 and as early as AD 100. A fourth one wrote back and said, "I think that this manuscript is probably written in the last decade of the first century, so in the 90s. That was a remarkable discovery, and it really changed an awful lot of ways in how biblical scholars have looked at when John's Gospel was written. One wag even said, "Well, the ink of John's Gospel must have been barely dry when P52 was copied from it." And so the idea was that John's Gospel was very, very late, middle of the second century, something like that. Well, since that time, a number of other manuscripts have been discovered. This is one that has just what, half a dozen verses, and it's only the size of the palm of my hand. But other manuscripts have also been discovered that are apparently from the second century. Scholars have debated in more recent years what the date of P52 is. We're not exactly sure because it doesn't say this was written at this time. And so we've got to make comparisons of this manuscript with other manuscripts whose dates are known. And they're known because they're non-literary papyri where someone says, "Dear so-and-so," and he writes it in the year of the reign of Augustus, his 14th year, or something like that. So we can pinpoint the date in time when we do that kind of thing. But there are other manuscripts from the second century as well. Papyrus number 66, which is at the Bodmer Museum in Cologne, Switzerland, on the shores of Lake Geneva, is a remarkable manuscript that has most of John's Gospel in it. It doesn't have the entirety of John anymore. The outside leaves have fallen off, and from chapters 14 on, it's fairly fragmentary. But P66 is a manuscript that was dated somewhere between AD 150 and AD 200, and yet it's got most of John's Gospel in it. Really a remarkable text. We also have several other manuscripts, P4, P64, P67. We've got others that are possibly second century, what's known as P75, which is a document that has both Luke and John in it, the vast majority of those verses. P46 is the earliest document we have of Paul's letters, It's housed now at the Chester Beatty Museum in Dublin, Ireland, and at least most of it is. The rest of it is housed at the University of Michigan. This manuscript is dated at about AD 200, so right on the cusp between the 2nd century and the 3rd century, and it has today most of Paul's letters in it. We know that it had far more material than it has now, although we still have the majority of what it has today. The reason is because the scribe actually wrote out what the page number was, and so we can see some of the later pages and figure out exactly how much this text would have had in it. These are some of our early manuscripts. Altogether, we have manuscripts from the 2nd century or possibly the 2nd or 3rd century that number as many as 10 or 12 manuscripts that are dated to about that time period. Now, in terms of how much material of the New Testament they have, the remarkable thing is that approximately 43% of all the verses of the New Testament, not the entirety of each verse, but 43% of parts of those verses, and in most instances, the majority of those verses, are found in these manuscripts that are dated to the 2nd century or to the 2nd/3rd century. That's an amazing amount of material very early on for the New Testament. Then you get into the 3rd century, and we have quite a few more manuscripts. In the 4th century, basically, by the time we get to within 300 years of the completion of the New Testament, we have well over 100 manuscripts in Greek alone, not counting the other ancient languages, the other ancient versions, that have the text of the New Testament, including our first complete Greek New Testament manuscript that has every book of the New Testament. The entire New Testament is duplicated many times over in these manuscripts that we have through the first 300 years after the completion of the New Testament. There's nothing in the ancient world that comes close to that in terms of the completion of material and the date of the material. We just don't have any parallels at all that even stand a chance against the materials we have for the New Testament. So what scholars have to deal with is this embarrassment of riches of massive amounts of material. And on the other hand, they have to deal with the early texts, and yet those early manuscripts very frequently differ from each other. They typically differ from each other more than the later manuscripts do that were almost cranked out, not by a printing press, but very, very carefully produced, but on a standard text that was changed significantly from the early text. So we've been talking about this embarrassment of riches. How much do we have of the average ancient Greek author, Greek or Latin author, how much do we have of his literary remains? The average author has fewer than, and I'm giving a very liberal estimate here, fewer than 20 copies of his literary remains still in existence. And most of these Greco-Roman authors would have just a handful, 1, 2, 3, maybe 6 or 7 copies, that's it. So giving a generous estimate of 20 copies, if you were to stack those literary remains up, how tall would it be? Well, on average, it would end up being about 4 feet high. If we had 20 copies of the remains, you'd get up to 4 feet high. Now, take the New Testament manuscripts in the Greek and all the ancient versions, how high would that stack be? That would be closer to about a mile high. It's a huge difference between these ancient Greco-Roman authors and their literary remains and what we have for the New Testament. Now, if you were to wipe out all of the Greek manuscripts and all of the ancient versions of the New Testament, would we be left without a witness? Not at all. We also have the fathers of the church, or ancient bishops and presbyters and elders and deacons who wrote commentaries and homilies on the New Testament. Beginning in the late 1st century, we start getting these church fathers who are making some minor comments on the New Testament as it was in a state of production. It wasn't really yet regarded as the New Testament until it became what's called canonized. That is when the church recognized certain books and determined that certain books would be considered scripture, which didn't. It took some time for that to happen. But in the meantime, these patristic writers in the late 1st century, 2nd century, 3rd century, all the way up through typically the 13th century is how we count them, are quoting from the New Testament and alluding to the New Testament. How much material do we have from the church fathers in terms of quotations and allusions from the New Testament? Well, the best estimate is that we have well over 1 million quotations of the New Testament by the Church Fathers for this period of time. That's a huge amount of resources, and the entire New Testament is reproduced again many times over in the writings of these Church Fathers. Finally, when you think in terms of the amount of material, there's another way to quantify this. Altogether, among our Greek manuscripts only, we have approximately 2.5 million pages of manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, which the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts is dedicated to digitizing as much as we are allowed to and as much as we are able to. Those 2.5 million pages average out to about 500 pages per manuscript. So the average Greek New Testament manuscript is about 500 pages long. This is a significant amount of material. We're not dealing primarily with fragments, but with some lengthy materials, and very early on we get this. When you compare the New Testament to the other ancient Greco-Roman literature, the remarkable thing is the average other Greco-Roman literature, the average author from Greece or from Rome, has no literary remains for at least 300 years, while as the New Testament has well over 100 copies in Greek alone within the first 300 years of the completion of the New Testament.
Kind of like drinking through a fire hydrant. But I wanted you to see all that because I wanted you to realize that that phrase, an embarrassment of riches, that really does apply to what we have in the New Testament. So I've got some summary points here that I wanted us to run through pretty quickly. So we don't have any originals. He said the word autographs. I don't know if you heard that term. We don't have any original copies of things from the New Testament. Like, we don't have the copy that Paul wrote to, you know, Corinth or Galatia or whatever. But that's not a problem that's unique to the New Testament. If you want to find any ancient author that you can say, oh, well, this is the one that the Roman historian Livy wrote, you're not going to do that. So if somebody wants to say to you, well, there aren't any original copies of the New Testament floating around, it's like, well, there aren't any original copies of any ancient author or historian floating around. So that's not a problem that's unique to the New Testament. I hope also that you recognize that there are thousands, he said thousands, of Greek manuscripts. And it's just Greek, not to mention Latin and Coptic and Syriac and Arabic and all these other languages. So the New Testament really does exceed, you know, other ancient works. There is also overwhelming agreement in these different manuscripts that were written in different places and at different times. Okay? So, for example, you take a copy of the Gospel of John from the second century. That little fragment that he showed, John 18. Yeah. That what it says there in John 18 is, you know, what it says in a copy of the Gospel of John from a totally different part of the world 200 or 300 years later. It seems like the manuscripts of the New Testament were, for the most part, pretty faithfully copied. Somebody isn't getting in there and saying, oh, I don't like what John said here about Jesus coming out of the tomb, so I'm going to delete that. That wasn't happening. That kind of thing isn't happening. There are also variations from manuscript to manuscript. As we read earlier, 1 Corinthians 13, some versions say, I give my body over that I may be burned. Other versions say, I give my body that I may boast. There are some variations, you know, and that's just something that we have to acknowledge. And if we try to hide our, you know, pull an ostrich and hide our heads in the sand away from that, you know, that's not good. We do have to acknowledge that. We also have, remember what he said from about the second century? So meaning just decades after the New Testament was finished. We have about 10 to 12 manuscripts. That's amazing when you compare that with some of these other guys he was talking about where their first copy doesn't show up till 300 years later. And we've got 10 to 12 from just a few decades afterwards. And that should be impressive. Chris is impressed. But we should think, wow, the New Testament really is something special. The New Testament really is something special. So like I said, compare that with other folks who were writing during the first century. Compare that with other folks who were writing during the first century. And talking about quotations from the church fathers, essentially if all the New Testament manuscripts that we have were lost, we would still be able to recreate the text of the New Testament from quotations from the first several generations of church leaders. And they had all kinds of different names back then. He said bishops and presbyters, elders and deacons, you know, all this stuff. So here's a quote that I wanted to read. This is from the interview from Bruce Metzger. He says, because even if we had no Greek manuscripts today, by piecing together the information from these translations from a relatively early date, we could actually reproduce the contents of the New Testament. In addition to that, even if we lost all the Greek manuscripts and the early translations, we could still reproduce the contents of the New Testament from all the quotations and commentaries, sermons, letters, and so forth from the early church fathers. That's a big deal. So I wanted to hone in on this thing real quick. Lee Strobel, in The Case for Christ, asks Bruce Metzger, what's the oldest scrap of the New Testament we have so far? And it's this papyrus fragment, 3.5 inches by 2.5 inches. Now imagine how well you must know the New Testament if a scrap no bigger than the size of my hand, you can read that and think, oh, well, that's from John. That's from John 18. Maybe if it started out from something like John 3:16, for God so loved, it's like, oh, that's John 3:16. You know, maybe that way we could get it. I don't know how many people love John 18 that much. But, you know, that's discovered in 1934. These are pictures. This is not the same picture flipped. This is the front side of it, and this is the back side of it. And you can see it's got, you know, margins up at the top. And it's, you know, these are Greek words. Garrett, what is that? I'm not going to do that to you, sorry. Yeah. And so what he was saying was in this collection of, in 1934, there was this guy who studies old manuscripts like this, sort of papyrologist, who was flipping through just a bunch of manuscripts that he bought in Egypt around 1920. And so the reason why Egypt is a big deal is because papyrus, it's brittle, especially after a couple thousand years. And so it gets preserved better in that dry, arid heat of Egypt. It would have fallen apart if it had been in Europe or someplace like that. So anyway, they had this stack of manuscripts and they're working through to see what's going on. They're not expecting to find anything from the New Testament. So that's why he was saying, when they do find something from the New Testament, that's a big deal. So he was saying that, you know, they bought this stack of things in about 1920. About 14 years later, this gentleman, Colin H. Roberts, who was one of the professors at Oxford University, he was sifting through some of these old papyrus and immediately recognized these texts from the Gospel of John. And so based on the style of the handwriting, he's able to date that fragment to maybe the first half of the second century. About first half of the second century. So then he took photographs of it and mailed it to other prominent, you know, people who studied papyrus manuscripts like that and asked them what their assessment of it was. And you remember what Dr. Wallace said? They independently, so they didn't all say, okay, we need to make sure that we have an early copy of John here, so let's date it early. That's not what happened. They looked at it and said, you know, based on what I know about handwriting and stuff like that, this looks like it's probably within the first half of the second century. So here's one thing why that's so fascinating. Before the discovery of this fragment, most people in the early 1900s and even late 1800s, most New Testament scholars at that time thought the Gospel of John had been written a lot later. They thought, there's no way the Gospel of John is based on eyewitness testimony. Look at how much John thinks about Jesus. In the Gospel of John, Jesus is, you know, telling people things like, you know, hey, I'm the Messiah. And it starts out with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Scholars at that time thought John was written a lot later, after Christians had had time to reflect on who Jesus was. And so basically they were calling the Gospel of John a fraud. Until the discovery of this manuscript. I'm like, well, wait a minute. If we're getting a scrap of this from Egypt, John lived in Ephesus after a while. If this is dated to the first half of the second century, John wasn't written in AD 160 like most people thought. Not Christians, but you know, scholars who didn't really have any faith commitments. And so this really showed a lot of people, wait a second now. Gospel of John was probably written a lot earlier than what we thought. And so that's a big deal. I mean, that's something that, you know, I look at and think, oh man, that's amazing. So here's some of the text. The Greek is up here. This is from the Wikipedia page on P52. The bolded portions are what is around here. And it says, the Jews, for us. And then what's missing back here, all the stuff that's missing. It is not permitted to kill anyone so that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke signifying. So the guy recognized the words, the Jews, for us, and anyone, and signifying, and die, and you know the letter P in the word Pilate, and Jews. Like that was the stuff that he recognized, and that's what made him think, oh, this is John 18. That's incredible. So I want to show you this gentleman. This is another gentleman who is putting all this stuff together. He says, in no other case is the interval of time between the composition of the book and the date of the earliest manuscript so short as that of the New Testament. The last foundation for any doubt that the Scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Frederick Crinion is another prominent papyrologist, one of the guys that Colin Roberts sent that fragment to. This is another one of the guys who looked at the pictures of this fragment of the Gospel of John. So, can we be confident in our New Testament? Absolutely, we can be confident that it was faithfully transmitted to us. So last thing, this is a preview for next week. Next week, we are going to get into the Bible and really hash some of this stuff out. Because there's still some issues we need to look at. For example, what's the deal with this whole stuff going on in 1 Corinthians 13? Is Paul saying that he's giving over his body to be burned, or is Paul saying that he's giving over his body to boast? Thank you all very much. You're dismissed.